We are in an anniversary period of time of the beginning of the Church of God International. It's something that perhaps we don't think about, though the Church of God International has not always existed. It was in the month of July in 1978, and I look around the room and I'm saying, now, who was here? Well, I see two people who were here, the Carnes, Guy and Jackie Carnes, and then I see a third person who was here, Nora Sharp, and if Benny was here, he would be a fourth. And that's about it in the room who were present in the beginning of the Church of God International. It couldn't hurt but cross my mind at all when I was in California last week, and out in Pasadena in particular, and to take a stroll through the campus of Ambassador College, where I had spent 12 years of my life, and think of the memories and think of the situation, because the Church of God International was born out of a relationship with the worldwide Church of God. That's the beginning. And that was a phrase that was thrown around in those days, new beginnings. It seems to be, and whenever you start a new adventure, the term new beginnings crops up. So the title of my sermon today is New Beginnings. But I couldn't help but think back to 1978 when it was clear that that Garnet Armstrong was not coming back to the Worldwide Church of God. I was still working for the Worldwide Church of God, and I was living on campus in an apartment building that I walked by and remembered the trauma of all of that in those days when Herbert Armstrong, the founder of the Worldwide Church of God, the Radio Church of God, as it was called in its beginning stages, felt he had to, well, put his son out of his organization. And Ted Armstrong concluded that he would begin a new adventure, a new beginning. He called it the Church of God International, which is really a play on the notion of a worldwide church. It seems to me that grandiose ideas require big names, because the sense of the church is that it is supposed to be worldwide. It is supposed to be international. It is supposed to, as Jesus Christ told his apostles and his disciples on the day in which he ascended into heaven, go into all of the world and preach the gospel. As a result, you're going to have folk part of this activity. Well, as I thought about it out there in those days, I used to drive up into the foothills of the mountains that surround Pasadena to get WOAI from San Antonio. That was the only station that Garner Ted Armstrong was on in those days. So it's quite a skip from San Antonio to California, but you could pick up the broadcast if you were up in the foothills of the mountains. And so I'd go to listen and hear what was being said. And you have to understand, from my perspective anyhow, that while I maintained the hope that he might be reunited with his father and we'd all go merrily on the way, when it became obvious that was not going to happen, then I had a decision to make, personally, as a number of people who were members of the Worldwide Church of God had to do. The anticipation was that there would be this groundswell of exodus from the Worldwide Church of God over to this new adventure, this new beginning, but it never happened. It never happened. What happened in the wake of that period of time till now is that you can't tell the players without a scorecard. There are so many derivatives, that is, offshoots of the Worldwide Church of God, that you just can't keep track. Now, 21 years ago, it was an unusual thing, an unusual circumstance, and so the Church of God International was born out of that. A lot of terms was given, born out of pain. A lot of notions were presented about that adventure. Some of those who were there in the beginning have gone on to start their own organizations. And yet, we celebrate today the anniversary of the beginning of this organization that we know of. Oh, it's gone through some serious times, some difficulties, some changes, but we're still here. I want to draw your attention today to three examples from the scriptures of new beginnings, where you can consider what the end will be relative to our adventure called the Church of God International. It is hard to tell the end from the beginning. Most people do not want you to tell them about the movie you saw and how excited you are about it, because they don't want to know the end before they see the beginning. But we have this little thing about us, this little glee, where we can tell somebody the end and blow it for them. But I'm so sorry. We even say things like, I don't want to give it away. But here's how it was. But nobody wants to know the end from the beginning, but the Bible is written in such a way that it tells us the end. It tells us the beginning. And it tells us a lot of things in the middle. Let us look then at three examples from the scriptures to help us in our minds. Many of you have come into the Church of God International, never having been members of the Worldwide Church of God, but you may have been members somewhere. And there's a history there. Maybe you have experienced coming from a church, though not in your time there, but subsequent to your leaving that association, where they have split, where they have gone in different directions, where there have been outgrowths from that initial deal. Well, just in Detroit this last week, I was able to attend a funeral of a lady I've known 43 years. When we first moved to Detroit and moved on Humboldt Street in Detroit, Michigan, from Columbus, Georgia, we lived in the middle of the block, and there was this lady who lived on the corner. And she had children around my sister's age and around my age. Her name was Irene. Irene suddenly died last Friday night, a week ago Friday night, and her funeral was held this past Wednesday. Well, the church that we grew up in was called Messiah Baptist Church. Messiah, I guess you could always assume that they'll be there forever. They celebrate anniversaries year after year. And what happened was, they called the pastor to the pastorate of the church. Make a long story short, they voted him out. The church splits. Now we have Messiah Baptist Church, and we have, it's amazing how the play on names happened, we have Messiah Mission, to signify that there was once a connection. You know, Church of God International, Intercontinental, or something like that. You know, we can come up with these titles, you see, but in the split, that reality is they're no longer together, but they're brought together in a moment in time because of the death of someone they mutually respect. And in the coming together, you soon realize that we are not together anymore. What started out as a grand adventure 70 plus years ago, this woman had been a member of that church since 1952. And as a result of her death, those who have memories of the time that they were united, they are no longer that way. Perhaps we should consider these three points, or these three examples today, in relationship to the Church of God International, and how we can extract the end of the matter from it. In the book of Joshua, in the first chapter, we find the presentation of Joshua coming to the leadership of the children of Israel, having been the direct assistant to Moses. Everything Moses did, he did it with Joshua somewhere in the proximity. When Aaron died, the high priest, it became necessary that Joshua take on even more responsibility. Moses loved Joshua. Joshua is a type of Christ because Joshua in Hebrew, Yahshua, means Jesus in our language, or the English language. Savior, that's what it means. So being a type of Christ in that, he carried the children of Israel into the promised land. Moses was not able to do that. Joshua did. But here at the beginning, notice what we learn in chapter 1 and verse 1. Now it came about after the death of Moses, the servant of the Eternal, that the Eternal spoke to Joshua the son of Nun, Moses' servant, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, cross this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving to them, to the sons of Israel. Every place on which the sole of your feet treads, I have given it to you, just as I spoke to Moses. Reading from the New American Standard Translation. From the wilderness of this Lebanon, even as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, these landmarks are still there today, all the land of the Hittites. By the way, when you read that term Hittite, just bears in mind that you should bear in mind that when you think of Uriah the Hittite, then you have some relationship. Uriah was married to Bathsheba, the husband that King David had killed, in order that he could have Bathsheba. He was a Hittite. That is, he was a person who had occupied the land, who had come to loyalty towards Israel. Yet his origins was in the people of the land that occupied, the people that occupied the land where the Hittites were, in the land of Palestine. As far as the Great Sea, this is the Mediterranean Sea, toward the setting of the sun, and you know it's the Mediterranean Sea, because when you travel west, that's the setting of the sun, you run into the Mediterranean, also called La Mer, in French, the Great Sea. This will be your territory. Verse 5, no man will be able to stand before you all the days of your life. This is in the beginning. Just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. I will not fail you or forsake you. Be strong and courageous, for you shall give this people possession of the land, which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous. That's in the beginning. You know how courageous one is in the beginning? You know, you think you can conquer the world, like after graduation. Get that new job, you start thinking, yeah, get me a new car because I got a check coming in and I've got all this going on. Or at the beginning of a marriage. I see a young couple here that are contemplating that. He's graduated from SFA, Stephen F. Austin down there, and he's kind of excited about the future. And therefore he can conquer the world with her by his side. That's the way that works. Be strong and very courageous. Be careful to do according to all the law which Moses, my servant, commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, so that you may have possession, have success wherever you go. This book of the law, he's referring to the first five books of the law, called the Torah, Genesis through Deuteronomy. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate on it day and night, so that you may be careful to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have success, predicated on the beginning of remaining faithful to God. Verse 9, have I not commanded you, he repeats it, this is the third time he says it, be strong and courageous. Do not tremble or be dismayed, for the Eternal, the Lord your God, is with you wherever you go. In the beginning. We could look at a lot of examples in the Bible about beginnings. We could go back to the Garden of Eden. That was a beginning. And Adam and Eve, and boy, the anticipation. I can imagine when Adam woke up from his surgery with the removal of that rib and the fashioning of Eve, who had no peer in the earth. You're talking about perfection? Barbaric had no chance with Eve. I can imagine him leaping and jumping and skipping around saying, "Wow! Wrap her up! I'll take her! But on second thought, leave her just like she is, and I'll take her." That's at the beginning. You know the end of that story. They were kicked out of the garden because of disobedience. At the beginning, excitement and anticipation. But something happens along the way, and it begins to be muddy. Let's take a look, verse 10 and 8, 10 through 18 for a moment, about the beginning, where Joshua gives the command to the people and tells them what do they need to do and so forth. He tells the Reubenites and the Manasseh and Gad, they're going to stay on the side of the Jordan, on the eastern side of the Jordan. But he tells them, you're going to have to work with us when we go in to conquer the land. The rest of the book of Joshua is about taking control of Palestine, or Palestine, since we are on Lake Palestine. Palestine is where they pronounce it over there. But anyhow, in order to conquer this people, we need every soldier available. And so the rest of the book of Joshua is about taking control of the land. Here is what we find in Judges then, to hear the end of this matter from the beginning. They conquered the land. It took a while to drive out those people who occupied the land, but God was with them, gave them victory after victory. The book of Joshua is about how the land was divided between the 12 tribes and all of that. That's what the book is about. But then there comes a time when Joshua dies. Second chapter of Joshua, and let's look at verse 6. After they had done a great deal of conquering and capturing of cities, we read in chapter 2 of Judges in verse 6, when Joshua had dismissed the people, the sons of Israel went each to his inheritance to possess the land. And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who survived Joshua. That is, for a prolonged period of time beyond Joshua, there were elders who were still alive, and they basically kept people in the right path. But that was to end. The people served, who had seen all the great work of the Lord which he had done for Israel. Then Joshua the son of Nun, the servant of the Eternal, died at the age of 110. He died. And they buried him in the territory of his inheritance, in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gash. And all that generation also who gathered to their fathers. And there arose another generation after them who did not know God, nor yet the work which he had done for Israel. And what happens? At the beginning, boy, they were gathered at the Jordan River, getting ready to cross over, and God performed a miracle. He caused, just as he caused the Red Sea to split, he caused the Jordan River to stop flowing and to split, and they walk across to take the land, and they went through battles and difficulties, but they conquered the land in the beginning. And what did God tell Joshua in the beginning? If you do like my servant Moses, if you adhere to my voice, if you obey my way, I'll be with you and no one shall withstand you. In the beginning. Verse 11. Then the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Eternal and served the Baals, served idols. And they forsook the Eternal, the God of their fathers, who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods from among the people, of the gods of the people who were around them, and bowed themselves down to them. Thus they provoked the Eternal to anger. So they forsook the Eternal and served Baal and the Ashtoreth, or Astarte rather, or Ishtar as some people pronounce it, from which we get the term Easter. Interesting that that shows up there in the scriptures, but many modern people do not argue. They think that's superfluous. But here is the example. The beginning, great glee and anticipation. In the end, they have turned a whole other way. If you went through the history of Israel, you could see this ebb and flow continually. A revival, a beginning, and then dissipation, then idolatry, then wandering in the wilderness of sin. That's the first example. The second example, one that is perhaps more striking, if you turn to 1 Kings. 1 Kings, we will deal with David, the king, dying. We'll turn to 1 Kings, the second chapter. As he's about to die, David only lived 70 years. Compare that to Joshua, who lived 110. Compare that to Moses, who lived 120. David, the great king, the greatest king, perhaps, of Israel's day, a man after God's own heart, only lived 70 years. He reigned over Israel as king for 40 years, 7 years he was over the house of Judah, and then the next 33 years he was over the entire house of Israel. He's preparing himself to die. The second chapter in verse 1, he says, David's time to die drew near. He charged Solomon his son, saying, I am going the way of all the earth. Everybody must die. Be strong, therefore, and show yourself a man, and keep the charge of the Eternal your God to walk in his ways. You'll notice a pattern as we go through this. The pattern is that whether God's talking, or Joshua is passing a message on to the children of Israel, or David to his son, it basically says the same thing. Here's what he says. Keep the charge of the Eternal your God to walk in his ways, to keep his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances, and his testimony, according to what is written in the law of Moses, the book of the law, Genesis through Deuteronomy, that you may succeed in all that you do and whatever, wherever you turn, so that the Eternal may carry out his promise which he spoke concerning me, saying, this is a very critical verse, often used in British Israelism to deal with the issue about that there will never be somebody who doesn't sit on the throne of Israel. Here's what he says about that. David is speaking, and he's saying what God told him. If your sons, if is a big word, isn't it? If your sons are careful of their way to walk before me, God, in truth, with all their heart and with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel. If we go through Israel's history and we see that's a big if. The house of Judah was carried into captivity. The house of Israel was carried into captivity, and the kings and their children killed because they didn't do this. And yet we still try to find succession, you know. People who are descendants of these people, well, God killed them. He allowed them to be killed because they didn't obey. They were carried into captivity because they were disobedient, and that they were idol worshipers. So here is the beginning. He tells them, be careful. Do what I'm telling you to do. Obey God, and it's going to go well with you. Well, over in the third chapter, we're continuing with the beginning, the start. The start where Solomon is going to take his father's words to heart. Of course, now in the second chapter that I won't deal with, I'll just mention that one of the things David told him to do is take care of some people, like Joab. Joab was a treacherous man. He had killed a couple of individuals, though he was the captain of the guard and all of that. David was very concerned that if Joab was left unchecked, he could cause difficulty for Solomon in his reign. In the second chapter, you'll read about Adonijah. He was the older brother of Solomon. Solomon had him killed. You can read about the why in the book. Joab was killed. Abiathar, the high priest, was removed from office and sent packing because he was a descendant of Eli, the old priest who had groomed Samuel and brought him up in the ways of God. And God had said, your children will not forever be the priests because of their sin. And so Abiathar was sent away, and Zadok the priest was put in his place. You read all of that in the second chapter. So there was business for Solomon to handle. But now we come to the third chapter, verse 5. We're talking about the beginning. Here's Solomon. Here's this great king, The Solomonic kingdom of Israel was so fascinating, as we will see. It is so stentorian in its approach. Look at what he asked for in chapter 5. In Gibeon, the Eternal appeared to Solomon in a dream at night, and God said, "Ask what you wish for me to give you." Solomon said, "You have shown great loving kindness to your servant David, my father, according as he walked before you in truth and righteousness and uprightness of heart toward you." Now, let's not forget what we're talking about. We're talking about beginnings. We're talking about the Church of God International as it started out. Perhaps a lot of this was in there, of walking with God, with our hearts toward Him, with righteousness and uprightness. The question is, where are we today? But that is an aside for the moment. "And you have reserved for him this great loving kindness, that you have given him a son to sit on his throne, as it is this day. And now, O Lord my God, you have made your servant king in place of my father David, yet I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. And your servant is in the midst of your people, which you have chosen, a great people who cannot be numbered or counted for multitude. So give your servant," he's now going to make his request, and this is how it is in the beginnings of things. It's kind of like how presidents may be in the beginning, or politicians may be in the beginning, or leaders of some kind, or maybe even husbands in the beginning. "Give me wisdom, give me patience, give me all of these things where I can be the right kind of leader within the family." And something happens along the way, but that's another aside. "So give your servant an understanding heart to judge your people, to discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of yours?" What an attitude in the beginning of recognizing limitations that are imposed upon us as human beings. We can't know everything, we can't do everything, we can't be everything. So we must turn to one who is everything. And that's what Solomon does with great wisdom. Continuing on, "And it was pleasing in the sight of the Eternal that Solomon had asked this thing. And God said to him, because you have asked this thing and have not asked for yourself long life, nor have asked for riches for yourself, nor have you asked for the life of your enemies, but have asked for yourself discernment to understand justice. Behold, I have done according to your words. Behold, I have given you a wise and discerning heart, so that there has been no one like you before you, and nor shall one like you arise after you." We still today, even in secular terms, refer to the wisdom of Solomon. To this day, there are people roaming the face of this earth, especially in this nation of ours, that seeks to find moral value, who will refer to the wisdom of Solomon. They will quote to you Proverbs 22:6, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he won't depart from it." That's because Solomon had it together in the beginning. But let's read on and see what the story is. Verse 13, "And I have also given you that which you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there will not be any among the kings like you of all your days. And if you walk in my ways," there's another big if, "keeping my statutes and commandments, as your father David walked, then will I prolong your days." That's an important, "as your father David walked." We all know David sinned. Oh, big time. David was unbelievable in the magnitude of his sin. At the time of the season, you know the story, of when kings went forth to battle, David stayed home, walking around on the roof of the house and spying out the land. And, ooh, who's that over there? Bathsheba. "Boy, she looks good," David said. You know the rest of the story. Brought her to the palace. Got to know her in the biblical sense. She becomes pregnant. Her husband is off in the military fighting a battle that David should have been at. at which David should have been, I guess is the best way to put that. Dealing with all of that situation, if we think that the things of the Bible have no relationship to what we live today, we are foolish. Because the same things go on today in the same way. You cannot argue that what went on in the White House is irrelevant to what David did. No way, no how. So you know how that happened. So when this phrase, as your father walked, understand, David repented. He repented deeply, transformed his life. So he is saying to Solomon, if you do like your father, if you should sin, there's a way back from deviating from the beginning. Then Solomon awoke in verse 15, and behold, it was a dream. And he came to Jerusalem and stood before the Ark of the Covenant of the Eternal and offered burnt offerings, made peace offerings, and made a feast for all his servants. He was excited in the beginning. Chapter 10. Just for a moment, let's call this the golden era. The height of glory for the kingdom of Israel with Solomon at the helm. You can relate this chapter to families, individuals, nations, or churches. There occurs sometimes a golden era. And when I was in Pasadena last week, walking through the week, it was 2 weeks ago today, walking in the campus there, and I mean, the buildings are magnificent. The grounds yet are tremendously beautiful. It's only when you get up close to see neglect in some of the buildings, because they're now occupied and it's up for sale and all those kinds of things, part of the heritage of the worldwide Church of God and its people. But you see it and you remember the golden era. I'm talking about fine art. I'm talking about buildings that are mansions in scope that the college owned or the church owned that housed students. The grounds won many awards. There is an auditorium that sits there. It's called Ambassador Auditorium with gold leaf. I mean, real gold on the underside of the stairways going up and that kind of thing. Beautiful crystal buildings, unbelievable ornate carpeting. Golden era, we shall call it. The great and grand age. So you can relate what we see in this 10th chapter to families. The moment in time when everything is just great, you can't turn around for not bumping into prosperity. When everything is going well. Perhaps as individuals, you can relate to it. As a nation, America's golden era, many people think, is behind it. And yet politicians proclaim, America's greatest days are yet ahead. You judge. Some of you with the white hair on your head can remember a time when things were better. Maybe not as much money in the bank, but better. And you see that as a golden era. Let's take a look at this 10th chapter for a moment. We're talking about beginnings. The Queen of Sheba. Sheba was one of the sons of Cush. That is, one of his sons had a child whose name was Sheba. You go back to the 10th chapter in verse 7, you can establish who Sheba was. Cush was one of Noah's boys. They were not Israelites. Cush dwelt in the land that we call Ethiopia today, which gives you an idea of who Sheba was, a woman of color, if you will, who came to Solomon. She heard about the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord. She came to test him with difficult questions. So she came to Jerusalem with a very large retinue, with camels carrying spices and very much gold and precious stones. When she came to Solomon, she spoke to him about all that was in her heart. And Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was hidden from the king which he did not explain to her. By the way, the last real ruler of Ethiopia was named Haile Selassie, who said in his tradition that he was a descendant of Solomon through Sheba, the queen of Sheba. So maybe they got to know each other real well. Solomon had this penchant, this proclivity that we'll read about here in a few moments, about the end from the beginning. Well, throw that in for your consideration. When the Queen of Sheba received all the wisdom of Solomon, the house that he had built, the food on his table, she observed everything about him. It says at the end of verse 5, there was no more spirit in her. She couldn't resist anymore. She said to the king, "It was a true report which I heard in my own land about your words and your wisdom. Nevertheless, I did not believe the reports until I came and my eyes have seen it. And behold, the half has not been told me. You exceed in wisdom and prosperity the report which I heard." Remember, we're still talking about the beginning. The beginning. Tremendous blessings that God bestowed upon Solomon, with such riches and such wealth that even to this day, the descendants of the Jewish people look back in awe at the Solomonic temple and the Solomonic kingdom. And the rest of the world observed it as well. Well, the rest of the story, you could read some of these things. Verse 21, "And all King Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and all the vessels of the house of the forest of Lebanon were of pure gold." Look at in verse 18, "He built a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with refined gold." I remember eating dinner at Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong's house one time, only time. We ate with gold flatware that he had purchased. I think it was Louis XIV setting that he had purchased in Europe at some point in time. And he would share it with the students to come over to the house and, you know, eat off of this fine china and fine crystal. I mean, the kind of stuff that doesn't work well at McDonald's. I mean, that's not where you would not put a Big Mac on these plates, you know. The meal was stupendous. I'm telling you, it was fine. I can't help but relate, if you see my connection, to Solomon's greatness and the glory of that kingdom. Verse 22, "For the king had at sea the ships of Tarshish with the ships of Hiram. Once every 3 years the ships of Tarshish came bringing gold and silver and ivory and apes and peacocks." When you read the book of Ecclesiastes about all the things that Solomon did, the very first chapter, he lived large, as they say today. How are you living? Living large and in charge. Well, Solomon was that way. That's merely the beginning, however. The rest of the story we find in chapter 11. Keep in mind and keep the focus about beginnings. A few of us were here in the beginning. Many have been added on the way. In this anniversary time of the Church of God International, we must relate these scriptures to our reality. Chapter 11. "Now King Solomon loved many foreign women along with the daughter of Pharaoh," and they named some of them: Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, Hittite women. Solomon had an eye for the ladies. Today they would call him a player. how much of a player? Well, let's read on down. "From the nations concerning which the Eternal had said to the sons of Israel, 'You shall not associate with them, neither shall they associate with you, for they will.'" Here's the reason for the not associating. It had nothing to do with race. It had to do with, "They will truly turn your heart away after their gods." Solomon held fast to these in love. Love. How many of you heard this before? Conquers all. It doesn't. Because he thought he could love these women out of idol worship. What turns out to happen was he started worshiping their gods. How many women are we talking about? Verse 3, "He had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned his heart away." A man with such wisdom, who had asked with such pensive, great, concise thought, "I need wisdom to judge your people." He didn't ask for money. He didn't ask for fame. Didn't ask for a long life, and God gave him the wisdom. But what happened? From the beginning, and all of the glory of this kingdom, what happened? Let's read on. For it came about when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Eternal his God, as the heart of David his father had been. What did David tell him? If you adhere like I did, what did God tell him? If you do like your father did, I'll be with you. But it didn't happen. Solomon went after Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians. He names all these gods, the Milcom, the detestable idol of the Ammonites. And Solomon did what was evil in verse 6 in the sight of the Eternal and did not follow the Lord fully as David his father had done. Which says there was a little, but not a lot. It goes down to list all of the things that went on in this period of time till you get down to verse 11. The Lord said to Solomon, because you have done this, and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes which I have commanded you, I will truly tear the kingdom from you, and I will give it to your servant. Nevertheless, I will not do it in your days for the sake of your father David, for I will tear it out of the hand of your son. However, I will not tear away all of the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to you, to your son, for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen. That gives us the precursor of the division between the house of Israel. Divisions happen. They happen. They happen after 17, 18 years. They happen after 40 years. Division, another word for it is divorce. So I can say, you could relate what I'm saying about new beginnings to families, to individuals, to churches, to organizations. Well, there's a third example to take a look at quickly. The beginning of the New Testament church. The book of Acts. What a beginning. What a time. What joy permeated the hearts of the people upon receiving the gift of the Holy Spirit. Chapter 2, verse 41. In this example of new beginnings, we read, so then, those who had received his word, Peter preaching, and were baptized, there were added that day about 3,000 to the church. Now, let's put that in perspective. We've got 35, 40 people, including the children, maybe more like 50. I'm not good at averaging crowds. There were 120 who were part of the disciples of Christ on the day of Pentecost. About 120. All of a sudden, 3,000 are added to that number. Wow. You're talking about excitement? You're talking about having this room filled? Would we be excited? Oh, yeah. Oh, man. I'd be dancing in the streets about that kind of excitement. But that's how it is in the beginnings of things. And they were continually, in verse 42, devoting themselves to the apostles' teaching, to fellowship, the breaking of bread, and to prayer. You notice what they were engaged in the beginning? No backbiting, no undercutting, no backstabbing, no lying and cheating and talking about anybody. All they did was adhere to devoted to the apostles' teaching, to fellowship, that is, getting to know each other back and forth, to the breaking of bread. When you share a meal together, it's hard, really, you know, to be evil towards one another. And to prayer. That's what they were doing. And to everyone kept feeling a sense of awe. And many wonders and signs were taking place through the apostles. And all those who had believed were together and had all things in common. They began selling their property and possessions and were sharing them with all, that anyone might have need. They were taking care of what needed to be done. And day by day, in verse 46, continuing with one mind in the temple and breaking bread from house to house, they were taking their meals together with gladness and sincerity of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. And the Lord was adding to their number day by day those who were being saved. That's how it started out in the beginning. Chapter 4, the intervening verse. Peter preaches again in chapter 3, chapter 4. They are arrested, Peter and John. They're taken before the council, demanded not to, and threatened not to preach anymore in Jesus' name. And they pray this great prayer at the end of chapter 4. It's a powerful prayer. It starts in verse 24. I won't read all of it, but here's what was the result of the prayer. This is how it was in the beginning, and I just have to ask myself, if we ever prayed like this, would this house ever shake? And when they had prayed, the place where they had gathered together was shaken. They were all filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak the word of God with boldness. In the beginning, it's easy to be bold, easy to be adventurous and courageous. But something happens along the way to rob us of that kind of boldness and the ability to pray like this prayer that we have here. And what does it produce? Look at furthermore in chapter 4 and the end of the chapter, verses 36 and 37. And Joseph, we never call this man Joseph. He was a Levite of Cyprian birth who was also called Barnabas. That's what we call him. That's what they call him. They called him Barnabas. By translation, it means son of encouragement or consolation. Man, he was an encourager. How did he do that? Well, he owned a tract of land. He sold it and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. That's how he was an encourager. Now, it's an encouragement to, if you are in need, somebody comes along and supplies your need. But that was the attitude that existed. And I believe that it needs to be more of the attitude of the church that Jesus built. And it is present in many of us, where we go to the ends of the earth almost to serve the needs of our fellow brothers and sisters in the faith. That's the way it should be in the beginning and the way it should be at the end. But then, and I want to refer to it, chapters 5, 6, and 7, we got an Ananias and Sapphira to contrast Joseph or Barnabas. They lie. They sell some property, and we sold it for so much so they could keep part of it. They could have kept it all. But they start the lying bit, and of course they die. Along comes a difficulty in the church about an argument in chapter 6 of who is being favored, who's being served more, and all of that. The battle, it says here in verse 1 of chapter 6, and at that time, while the disciples were increasing in number, a complaint arose on the part of the Hellenistic Jews against the native Hebrews, all of them Jews, because their widows were being overlooked in the daily serving of goods. Now, why were they overlooked? Well, there's a tendency among ourselves to cater to those people who are like us. And in a fellowship situation where you may know certain people, you need to break away from those people and go to people you don't know. You see, to continue the development. And they had that problem. Seventh chapter, of course, Stephen gives his testimony, powerful one. He was one of the seven chosen in chapter 6 to manage the affairs of making sure everybody was served appropriately. And he's put to sleep. He's killed. We're introduced then to this Saul character whose name is later changed to Paul. The point is that as you examine the beginning of the church, when everything was happy and running smoothly, you began to see pot marks show up and faults and error and difficulty. We see it in life. In our personal lives, we see it in churches. In this 21st year of the Church of God International, with the horizon before us, where are we? What do we hope for? It's not the beginning. No, the beginning is past. Can't go back and erase the beginning. The beginning is what it is. While in Pasadena last week, I had not done this. I was in California twice since the death of Herbert Armstrong, but I had not taken the time to do what I did on that particular Sabbath. I went to where he's buried. And I stood there. It's a family plot in some sense because four folk are buried there. His mother, who died at the age of 96. His wife, Loma Dillon Armstrong, is also buried there, and he rests between the two of them. And then Richard David Armstrong, who is the son who died in 1958 as a result of injuries from an automobile accident. They're all four buried on this plot with the Armstrong name. And so I took some pictures as well as just stood for a moment and thought. He died in 1986, and so it's been a while. But I had to be grateful for some things. I know it's not popular to talk in terms of appreciation for Herbert Armstrong, but there are things I learned in the beginning that have helped sustain me through the middle and hopefully to the end. You have to think of things in those compartmentalized ways because of some scriptures I'll share in closing with you. The beginning is not the end. Somewhere along the way in the course of our lives, we have difficulties. Don't we rejoice sometimes at the stories of people who maybe were boyfriend and girlfriend in high school and went their separate ways for some reason or another, married and had families and children and grandchildren, and through death and circumstances are brought back together 40 or 50 years later and write a new beginning on a new story of great joy of their sharing together? That's a one story to rejoice about. In the beginnings that we've had as a church, with all that has happened in the middle, let's look at Ecclesiastes, the 12th chapter, quickly, because that gives us some idea of this man Solomon and his thinking. Oh, he messed up. Solomon messed up so badly from his beginning. But even in that aberration in his mind, he could write these words, beginning in verse 11 of chapter 12. The words of wise men are like goads, the coverings, and masters of these collections are like well-driven nails. They are given by one shepherd. But beyond this, my son, be warned. The writings of many books is endless. We know that today. And excessive devotion to books is wearying to the body. The conclusion, when all has been heard, is fear God and keep His commandments, because this applies to every person. The King James says this is the whole duty of man, of human beings. Because God will bring every act to judgment, everything which is hidden, whether it is good or evil. Nobody ever got away with anything where God was involved with the nation of Israel. In their beginnings, their revivals, and in the end. That's what Solomon concluded. Which is why when people ask me, well, what's going to happen to Solomon? Is he going to be in the kingdom? I don't know. That's God's choice. That's his decision. We just know he messed up. Worshipping idol gods and doing all kinds of things with the wives that he had. But it's God's choice about what's going to happen to him. The book of Revelation, in the 21st chapter, and I have one more verse after this. The book of Revelation, the 21st chapter, we read in verse 6 these words about beginnings. He said to me, this is John writing it, and what Christ had said to him, it is done. I am Alpha and the Omega, which is Greek alphabet for those who don't know. It starts with the Alpha and ends with Omega. That's the Greek alphabet. This was written in Greek. The beginning and the end. We would say, and many times we do say, A to Z. A to Z. Everything from A to Z, or from soups to nuts. We have a way of saying things that are inclusive. And so here we're saying, I am the beginning and the end, Alpha and Omega. I will give to the one who thirsts from the spring of the water of life without cost. He who overcomes shall inherit these things, and I will be his God, and he will be my son. Here's the same promise that you read with Joshua. The same promise that David passes on to Solomon. And any place you look in the Bible, you will see essentially the same thing. This is what Solomon says. The whole of man will produce this. Verse 8. But for the cowardly and the unbelieving and abominable and murderers and immoral persons and sorcerers and idolaters and all liars, their part will be in the lake that burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. Oh, that's not a good end. But for you, brethren, here today, continuing in the faith, Philippians 1 and verse 6 is for you. It's for you in wonderment about the future. It's for those who were here in the beginning and are now having been through crises of all the kinds and the descriptions, must count on this word in Philippians 1 and verse 6. As Paul writes to this church, he says, and he might say to us, "For I am confident of this very thing, that he who has begun," beginnings, "a good work in you, will perfect it until the day of Christ Jesus." What's the future? How does it go? Well, we know that beginnings, new, old, or indifferent, are not the end. Thus, let us contemplate the end by going to the end to see what the end will be.
Thank you for listening to this cassette tape of the Church of God International. Feel free to contact us with any additional literature or tape request at Post Office Box 2525, Tyler, Texas 75710, or call 903-825-2525, or email us at armorofgod@email.com. Thank you.